Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome back to another edition of BOA Audio, episode 20 of the season. So we're really, we're rounding the third corner of the mile, if you will, I guess. I don't know what you'd call it, the third lap or something. But we're getting closer to the end here. It's getting a little scary. And tonight's show is going to be awesome. I'm really looking forward to it because as one door closes, one opens, I guess you could say, or as one show winds down, a new one is born. And our guest tonight has created a really fascinating podcast and a really interesting and exciting and fantastic show that I have dived into, or over the last couple of days, and have just been really blown away by it. And so I'm really looking forward to talking to him. He's been on the show before in the past, of course. He's the author of The Chaos Conundrum. That was what we were talking about a while back now, probably like 4 years ago or so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and he's also the author of Extraterrestrials and the American Zeitgeist, Alien Contact Tales Since the 1950s, and Conspiracy Theories, The Roots, Themes, and Propagation of Paranoid Political and Cultural Narratives. And the new show is called The Saucer Life, and it's the brainchild of, let me see what I have here. It's the brainchild, really, of a superhuman person of unwavering courage and nobility. And, of course, I'm talking about Aaron Gulyas. Aaron, welcome back to the show. Congratulations on this program. It really is something else. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back. It has been about 4 years, hasn't it? That is wild.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I was thinking about it. We got the chance to hang out in the summer of 2016, and I was like,
right.
Jesus, I'm just getting this guy on the show now. And then I'm like, well, asshole, you didn't do show practically for a year. So it's like I wasn't really doing anything to get you on. So I'm glad. Now that we're here in the final season, I knew I wanted to get you on, and then I saw you were at Shag, and I'm like, all right, I gotta get my act together here and get Aaron on the show. And I had known you had launched this podcast in August, but I mean honestly, as a podcaster and someone who works in the paranormal media, it's like I try and avoid these things like the plague because A, it's my job, and B, you know, it's like, as a producer of this stuff, also, you always kind of, like, compare. You know, if I listen to other interviews, I'm going to be like, ah, shit, I should have asked that or whatever. Or they did a better job than me. You know, it's like always second-guess yourself. But your show is completely different from, I guess, what people may be used to from paranormal podcasting. It really is, I guess, and I'll sort of do the thumbnail for folks, and then we'll sort of talk into sort of how you can see this and stuff. But
sure.
What it really is Aaron just telling these stories. He has sort of a preamble like we do, you know, no commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. But and he can tell us what those are in a moment. I hope he remembers them. But one of them is no guests. And it's just Aaron telling these stories. It has a really, like, NPR feel to it, and I mean that as a compliment. I know some
– cool.
So I know maybe there are some listeners who are like, wow, fuck that. But it has a real – you have, like, a really it's like – I'm going to sound silly for saying this. Like, you have a really, like, soothing voice. It's very, like – I really enjoy listening to it. It was like, I'm going to tell you a story now. And it's like, whoa, this is really, really, really cool. So – I loved it. I listened. I'm going to give you the curse of the podcaster now, which is that I love it so much. I want you to do more of it. I want you to do it all the time, and it should always stay free. So that means you're welcome to the club.
Yeah. Yeah. It's it was interesting when I was thinking about doing it. I started off thinking of doing the same sort of thing, but have it be a lot more narrow. You know, contactee of the week, or something like that. And I actually ran that idea past Joshua Cutchin, and he thought that was a great idea. And then when I thought about it more, I realized, yeah, I need to widen it out a little bit more. So it's just more general flying saucer and UFO stories. And I'm trying to find stories, or at least angles on stories, that aren't generally talked about. My basic idea when I was planning it out was, what if Dan Carlin, who does his Hardcore History podcast, did a podcast about flying saucers, but it was only a half hour long in every 2 weeks instead of 12 hours long every year?
Right.
And so that was sort of the impetus for it. And and also I kind of miss writing about this stuff, but I have no desire to actually write about this stuff. So writing something for sort of a spoken presentation is sort of scratching that writing and research itch without you know, staring down the barrel of a book or a chapter or an article or something like that. So that's sort of where it came from.
Yeah. Well, I mean it, dude. I wish you were doing this like once a week. When it was over, like, I want more of these. Hurry up. I guess I told you, dude. I'm giving you the curse of the podcast. I'm like, hurry up and make more of these, dude. I want to hear another one. I'll give you credit. I mean, there's probably other people. There's always somebody who was like, I did it first. So there's probably some other show out there that's been doing this, but yours is like the first I've heard that presents it, you know, in the way that you do, like as a program without interviews and stuff like that. I thought,
right,
I think it's really, and not in a sense, but like some shows they don't have a guest that week, so they're just like, hey, we're just gonna shoot the shit. It's like,
yeah.
No, this is the purpose of the show is to tell these stories, and it's, I haven't seen that in the paranormal field where it's just like guest of the week on all the shows, but All of America included. So, you know, I'm impressed by the innovation.
Yeah, thanks. I think there probably are ones like this out there about the broader weird sort of world. I think lore is one of those that's sort of like this. But my claim to fame is I'm shorter. I sort of time the episodes for, well, what's sort of a good commuting length? So if you're in your car, you're driving to work, or you're going wherever, it's 20 minutes, it's a half hour of an interesting little story that you are free to go and dig into more on your own. But I'm not going to, you know, go into exhaustive detail. I'm going to find, you know, little fun bits of things and go with that.
Yeah. Well, that's another point, yeah, which I really liked a lot, because as someone, like I said, I try to avoid these shows and also because of the time commitment, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, if you want to listen to, like, three or four podcasts that are out there, that's like 6 or 7 hours of your week, possibly, you know? And so when I saw the links to yours, I'm like, wow, these are really short. But they pack so much in. They're so entertaining that it's like, I kind of like this better than listening to a 2 hour show. Like that,
right.
I got all the stuff there in a nice sort of presentation. So I'm really, really blown away, man. I really, I didn't know what to expect, and I was like, wow, this is really different.
Yeah. Thanks. That's kind of what I was going for. It's something that is different and entertaining and digestible and allows me to show off my FM radio soft rock DJ voice.
Yeah.
Adequately. So, yeah.
Yeah, Delilah. She better watch her back.
I could be the male Delilah. That's that's my next thing. The thing is, if I were to use my, I don't know, my radio voice in class when I'm teaching, it would feel weird. It's a different sort of voice. I think in class I'm a lot more shouty and less calm because I'm trying to keep people awake. Because sometimes you know, the origins of Buddhism at 9 o'clock in the morning don't really engage people. So I think the audience will appreciate this, I think. I was talking about Plato's allegory of the cave the other day in class, and I think I actually used the word sheeple.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so I used that. So then some students started using sheeple as sort of like, this is what we were saying. Like, I gotta nip this in the bud. But instead, what I did was I sort of talked about conspiracy theories for like 30 seconds, and I lapsed into this sort of slacker 90s conspiracy guy voice and said something like, man, you know, you pull one thread of the tapestry and it all starts to unravel, man. And you know, they killed Bill Cooper. It killed Bill Cooper, you know, and then like, anyway, that was me at parties in the 90s. And so then I just went, I don't know what I was talking about, but it's weird how, you know, you live sort of half in this world of studying these stories and these people for 10 or 15 years. And then it sort of leaks out into your everyday life and people look at you strangely, so, especially since many of my students were toddlers when Bill Cooper died back in 2001, I think. So, they were toddlers. They were alive, but they were young. So, who's Bill Cooper? I'm like, that's your grandparents.
Yeah, it's weird. I'm just imagining that scene, yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. Well, it's been a long, it's scary how time flies in a way. You're right. These kids that are in your classes and stuff are like, they weren't even, I always sort of like, for some crazy reason, because I'm a pop culture junkie, I always sort of like, think of like John Candy, who died like at the wrong time where like no one like who's those kids' age like would know who John Candy was. But like they all know who Chris Farley was. It's like there was a certain like window of time where people became forgotten or something. It's very weird.
Yeah, I remember John Candy.
Like right before all the stuff that sort of happened, like right before the internet, people like don't quite remember.
When you watch people on TV and then you heard about their death in a newspaper or on the nightly news, and you know
exactly.
It wasn't this, you know, everybody finding out within 5 minutes of it happening. Technology has changed quite a bit, and I like it. But I mean, it's weird how sometimes I'm nostalgic for a time before social media and when the internet meant I had to dial in on my modem and I couldn't really be on the internet very long because other people had to use the phone. We're not nostalgic for no internet. We're nostalgic for being 18 or 19 or 20. That's when we associate, oh gosh, I'm such a nerd. I associate dial-up modems with my early 20s. That's pitiful. I think it's more of a midlife crisis. I remember when I was young and I had to dial in.
They'll never get it. These youngsters, they'll never get it. Well, speaking of nostalgia, this is a good segue sort of to jump back to the show.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Do you find any – because I always found it difficult all these years doing the show, sort of doing the model – like in the old style before we went live all the time, I would tape – these like terrible sort of like intros where I read the bios and shit. If I ever like repackaged the shows, I'll probably cut all those out because I just hated doing them. I felt they were like so stilted. And people used to be like, why is it taking so long for the show to be up? And it's like, because I'm sitting here at my desk like hating doing these things. So eventually, like, we don't do them anymore. The show, you notice we do the show a lot faster.
Yeah.
So, like, I guess. It's a challenge, I think, I found, but maybe you don't, to, like, sort of sit there and just talk. Do you go back and, like, listen to them? Because that was always my problem. Like, I would go back and listen to the little voiceover part, and I'd be like, I fucked that up. I gotta, you know, and I'd start, like, nitpicking tiny things.
Yeah, what I usually do is I also use this podcast as an excuse to buy, you know, stuff, right? Audio stuff. So I've got an XLR mic that plugs into a Zoom H4 recorder. And I just sort of record into that. And I do it in little pieces. So if something is screwed up, I can go in and edit it without having to find the spot in, you know, an hour's worth or 30 minutes worth of material. So I record the bits and pieces and I assemble them all in GarageBand and apply filters and things like that. And what I found is that it took me about 2 hours to assemble it all and to edit out the gaps and to make everything sort of flow well. And I've got that down to about like 20 minutes now. So it's gotten faster, but I don't think I've ever listened to an entire episode all the way through. I probably should, but I don't. I sort of skip here and there as I'm editing, and so I hear most of it as I'm working on it. But
yeah.
One time, I think it was the third episode or something like that, I was listening to a bit of it after I had uploaded it. It was like 1 a.m, so I knew nobody was going to be paying attention to it. And I got done saying a sentence, and there was a pause, and then the pause kept going, and I said something like, ah, shit, I got to do this one over.
Oh, no.
So I could go in and yank the stuff off and re-upload a file and make sure that the iTunes feed and everything was showing the right one.
Right, right.
And so I was up till 3 when I'd been planning to go to bed at 1. But
yep.
It was that was a little nerve-wracking. I've tried to listen a bit better as I'm working on it. But I don't mind the talking into a mic or sort of reading off a script. I've been doing audio and video things like this for the classes that I teach that are online for 3 or 4 years now.
Okay.
So I've kind of gotten used to the whole process and not hating my voice too much. So it's not too bad. I have tried to, in various types of projects like this, to try to be more spontaneous when I talk. And what I get is a bunch of gaps and a bunch of mistakes and a bunch of things I have to go back and fix. So
I find
that writing it out and actually reading it and working on reading it with some animation, but not reading too fast and reading like I'm talking to somebody, working on that process has been kind of fun.
Yeah.
It's kind of helped. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a unique challenge, I guess, that maybe some folks wouldn't understand, but it's like, as having done all this for years, it's like, I know exactly. Yeah. You find some terrible thing like at 1 a.m. and
yeah,
you're up all night, like trying to fix it. Yeah. Well, the show really, it's inspiring in a lot of ways because it's like, all right, I mean, I have a ton of crazy ideas for when we wrap up the show. So it's like, it kind of was like, all right, there's room out there for new ideas, man. Like Aaron's doing new stuff. Bruce Pretty's sort of launching an interesting show that kind of sounds like it's going to be different from the pack. So it's like, there's really an outlet, a yearning for like different stuff. And your stuff is so good that and different and unique and well put together that I think it's going to be awesome.
I agree that there's more room for some experimentation.
Exactly.
I think we've passed the first wave of and I don't even know why I think about these things, but I think we passed the first wave of paranormal podcasting, which is basically trying to do an online version of the Art Bell Show.
Yeah.
And without the callers, because doing callers on internet stuff can be a real hassle probably. But I think we've gotten to the point where I don't know if we've exhausted that format, but I think that format has sort of reached the end of its useful life.
Yes.
People have their shows that they like to listen to, and I'm not that interested in seeking out another show that's interviewing the same people who are saying the same things. I've got my shows to do that. I listen to your show. I listen to Radio Misterioso and Soraya Abkaff's Where Did the Road Go? I drop in on that occasionally. And so, you know, that sort of about everybody I've ever wanted to hear has been on those three shows, right?
Yeah.
I don't really feel the need to, you know, here's another show where they're interviewing, oh God, I don't want to say a name because I'll offend somebody.
Yeah, someone you've seen, someone you heard on a million shows. Yeah, it's like,
right.
I joke on the show too where it's like, and you're a great example in a good way, but it's like, when the guests have podcasts, what's the point of being a podcast? Like,
yeah. There's, and I've noticed a lot more of guests on the interview shows are podcasters themselves, and there's not anything wrong with that. But as evidenced by my discourse on finding audio mistakes at 1 a.m, it gets to be a little bit inside, you know?
I've talked about that on the show a lot this year, where what I call I don't know how much you've been listening to the season, but it's like the UFO bubble, like the people who,
right.
You know, it's very sort of like incestuous, not necessarily in a bad way, but it's very like people, it's an echo chamber in a lot of ways.
Right. And, you know, there's sometimes, depending on who's doing the talking, it can be really cool to be the person eavesdropping on a conversation between two good pals talking about a topic you're interested in. But if it's not the right mix of personalities, sometimes it just isn't a good experience for the listener sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think it's cool is that in the last couple of years, we've been hearing more and more from some new and different voices out there. We've been exploring the weird stuff in ways that is, I don't know if I want to say the previous generation have, but we're seeing some different stuff. We're seeing guys like Cutchin, coming out and talking about fairies, right? And Red Pill Junkie, you know, doing his thing, and all these newer voices that are emerging, which is great. And I think we need more of that. But at the same time, those new voices are going to be the old voices in a few years.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, we got to keep cultivating this new generation
of investigators.
You've been around forever.
Yeah.
You've been around for a long time. I was looking on some old US of E posts a while ago, and I was like, I cannot believe that Binal's been around for this long. Because, I mean, not in a bad way, but.
That's what my doctor says,
like,
too.
How are you still alive?
Yeah.
It's like, wow, it's like 10, 12 years, something like that. So
yeah, it's been like 12 years of doing shows and 10 years like of shows.
Not to turn it into a This Is Your Life episode, but I think I remember my first exposure to the Binal world was you had a transcript, a review, or a write-up of this crazy woman named Sherry Schreiner on the Jeff Rentz show. And she was talking about her prophecies and her Bible code stuff. And your write-up was just so like, oh my God, I can't believe this person's saying this. What am I listening to? What have I done with my life? I was like, I like this. So, you know, that's at least 12 years ago that,
easily,
happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause, we talk about like people who wouldn't know, about John Candy and shit. Jeff Rentz, like, some people probably never even heard of him. It's like, when I got into this, it was like Coast to Coast and Jeff Rentz. Jeff Rentz was like the WCW to Coast to Coast WWE or whatever. And it was, he went the way, I don't know, I think he's still around. I think he still has a show, but it's like,
it's all just neo-Nazis now.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything, and I don't know anyone who goes on the show. I don't know anything about it. I think it's sort of like a watered down version of like Alex Jones or something that I don't even know.
That's a good description of it. I don't listen to the show. Sometimes I do. There's this guy, Clark McClelland, who worked for NASA and claims to have all sorts of inside information.
Of course
he does. I don't know why I listen to it, because it's so sad. He doesn't really say anything of substance. And he mostly complains about how the diabetes took his leg and he needs people to send him money because he's broke.
Don't you hate people like that?
It's frustrating, but there seems to be a lot of it about, you know. I feel bad for him because apparently he got screwed out of his pension or something. But, you know, Rentz will say something like, well, why don't you publish your book that you're working on instead of, you know, he sells it. His book per chapter is PDFs for like $5 a piece or something. And he said that basically the world Zionist conspiracy won't allow any publisher to publish his book. And I'm thinking,
God,
you're not working hard enough, man. You can click 3 buttons on Amazon and you can have a Kindle book.
Yeah. Does he
there.
Think like this?
Yeah.
He's like, he thinks a little paperclip that pops up to help him with Word is the Zionist conspiracy. It's like, no, dude, you just don't know how to copy and paste.
All right. It looks Hi, I'm Clippy. It looks like you're trying to explain how white people are really the descendants of aliens from the Aldebaran system.
Yeah, it's like, are you sure you want to publish that?
Yeah, I was like, well, of course I do. So, yeah, Rents has fallen on
strange times.
And I don't listen to Coast to Coast lately, mostly because I've got, like, this array of podcasts that I listen to, and that's pretty much all the listening time I have. Back when I commuted 2 hours a day, I listened to all kinds of stuff. But nowadays, I just don't have the time. When there's a guest I'm interested in, I'll tune in. But for the most part, I just, you know, I've got this very sort of constrained diet of audio.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like the market share of paranormal radio or audio has, like, exploded in recent years. So, but you're... The Saucer Life is a welcome addition to the mix. I feel like we've done all this all this in-house stuff. So what, I guess, talk about sort of like how this like era of, you know, the flying saucer lore, you know, the 50s, 60s, this sort of the contactee era and all right. this stuff. So I guess talk about like why this has taken a hold in you, why that's sort of like your favorite. Clearly it's like your favorite.
It is.
Era of ufology.
I think what I like about it is I like the way it is very easy to find stories that are interesting and fun or somehow, you know, affecting or even emotionally affecting sometimes. So easy when you look back at contactee stuff and even some non-contactee stuff from the 60s and onward. It's easy to find stuff that nobody or very few people have ever heard of. And so it's a real fertile ground for finding things that and exploring things that haven't been heavily explored. That's one of the reasons I worked on contactee stuff in grad school and the first book I wrote is because there really wasn't anybody publishing books and articles about contactees. There's a whole lot of stuff sort of deconstructing abduction narratives. There's a lot of stuff about that, a lot of stuff about you know, UFO conspiracy type things, a lot of stuff, especially years ago, about Heaven's Gate and UFO cults and things. But the old school contactee things really got glossed over in the academic world for a while there. So I was like, well, I'm going to, you know, hop on this. And then with the podcast thing, it's, you know, these are stories I just love to tell. A lot of these are stories that when I end up cornering people at parties or at meetings and they say, oh, hey, like his son does, and stuff, I'll say, yeah, have you heard about Al Bender? I'm going to tell you about Al Bender. And so, you know, then people start to leave me alone. So that's great. But they're interesting stories. They're interesting personalities. And they've got these little bits of their life that are just strange, or that they are telling people are strange for whatever reason, whether it's George Adamski trying to, you know, promote ideas of universal peace while making money, or Truman Bethlehem, who, like I said in the podcast, it may be the first case of somebody inventing a contactee story in order to make their wife jealous.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, that was
I've
really
the sexy saucer lady, you know, on the side. So
yeah, that was like fascinating to me. Can we stop and talk about the Truman Bethlehem? Because I was like, just I was riveted by that story in a sense. Because like I was thrilled because you sort of like took the idea from my head and then got into it on the show, which was great. Which was just like, okay, if we sort of like stop and say, all right, maybe let's just assume this is all bullshit, that this guy's not like meeting a UFO and a sexy lady captain running the UFO. And it's like, let's just stop and it's like, what might really be going on here? And it was so like bizarre. It's like, as you say, he doesn't have any greater agenda here. It's like, he just weaves this fantastic tale about meeting this sexy space lady alien captain and how his wife was, like, jealous. And it's like he's clearly, like, working through some kind of issue here. Now, as he's telling, like, the story that he tells, obviously it's from his point of view, but his wife was really, like this. He was really having these arguments with his wife, ostensibly, right or no?
Yeah, she was. She just knew that he was telling stories that he had met this woman, and she was from a flying saucer, and whatever. And so she writes to his grown daughters from a previous relationship, and asks if he has any history of mental illness or if he's ever been committed. And according to the book that he wrote, it took a visit from, in quotes, Professor George Adamski to come visit his wife and say, no, the space people are here, and I'm sure that Truman has met these people from the planet Clarion, and I'm sure they have this wonderful message to spread. But Bethlehem's message was not like the underlying sort of political or social message he had was fairly undeveloped. Aura Raines, the sexy saucer captain, says that on Clarion everybody goes to church, and that's pretty much her description of there's God and we all believe in Him, and that's sort of the religious message. And
as opposed to
Adamski's sort of, you know, system of cosmic philosophy and things like that.
Yeah,
and
this is more like a telenovela. This is like a soap opera involving him and a sexy lady alien, and how like everybody believes him but his wife. It's very weird. It was like, my God. Yeah.
And it's honestly a very sort of chaste relationship. I mean, there's no like Antonio Vias Boas style action going on.
Nice.
It's mostly, you know, he just clearly just kind of has a crush on this woman. And it's very sweet. And then after the first book, he writes a couple of other books, and she sort of shows up in weird cameo roles to explain, you know, how, you know, communism ain't great or something like that. But she sort of fades from the scene. So what I think happened is he wanted to keep writing saucer books because of the sweet saucer book money, but his wife really did not want him talking about Aura Raines anymore. And of course, he and his wife ended up getting divorced, I believe, sometime in the early 60s, I think. So, you know, there were problems in the marriage, and Aura Raines didn't help.
I can imagine. Now, I think one of the sort of like, and I had known this before, but I think having listened to the show and having, I think I may have even thought this in Canada, because I think you had brought it up. But I think, in a sense, like one of the weirdly sort of tragic elements in a lot of this is that Al Bender only died like in 2016, and it's like I wish you of all people could have met him, like, because it's like such a star-crossed situation where it's like if only you had been doing this 5 years ago, you probably would have met him. It's like, oh, Jesus.
You know, from what I understand from talking to some people, he did not want to talk to anybody.
Yeah,
about,
I think if like
about,
I think he would have cracked for you. I think honestly,
I like to think that at the very least, I should have. You know, I could have written him a letter and saying, I know you don't want to talk about this. I know that you know, I have no expectation of a reply, but I just want to tell you that I think your story is one of the most intriguing and interesting stories out there, not because of the Men in Black and not because that you met men from the planet Kayak who had a base in Antarctica, but because it's the story of a young guy who's coming up with a story that is weird and that is getting him attention, and then he suddenly realizes it's not the sort of attention he wants, but he keeps coming back and until he finally is able to escape it and go on and have this great life with his wife and his kids and his work with the Max Steiner Music Society and the work he did with the archival work he did with them, restoring audio recordings and things. You know, he just was able. What I like about Al Bender is I'm not sure if there's any other flying saucer personalities from any era who were able to so fully and completely leave it all behind.
Yes, yes.
And escape and go have a real life and not be tied to the UFO conference circuit for the rest of their natural days.
He wasn't per se a researcher. He was, for lack of a he was an experiencer per se, like,
yeah,
quote unquote. So he was like, you know, that makes it even more remarkable. Now, I hesitate to ask because, like, you, I guess some people might be like, well, don't do that. But, like, have you ever considered, like, reaching out to his sons or his children to see if they ever have any insights into all this? Because I feel like if you ever, like, write, I know you've written a bunch of books, but, like, you should consider an Al Bender biography because I bet you there's like a lot of interesting, if you could sort of track that tail end of his life, I bet you would be interesting.
Somebody,
he had to have opened up to somebody or some people or his family, you know what I mean, in later years.
Yeah. I would like to think so. I think that would be a good job for somebody to do, and I'm not sure I'm the one. The thing is, thinking about sort of biographies, I just got a bunch of one of the volumes of reprints of Richard Toronto's Richard Shaver Hollow Earth fanzine that he did back in the 70s. And he wrote a biography of Shaver called War Over Lemuria a few years ago. And the key to his success in starting up this fanzine and then having the materials to write this autobiography of Shaver is that he had a relationship with Shaver before Shaver died. And so he was sort of a known quantity to the family and everything. And I think, I don't know, it would be interesting to see what, if anything, Bender talked to his family about.
Right,
about
right.
this about this time, because you know there's the sort of standard sort of skeptical point of view that he made it all up to get out of the whole IFSB club that he had formed, that he wanted to stop doing that.
How old was he when all this went down? Over the course of sort of the tumultuous UFO years.
Yeah,
how old was he? Because he was 91 when he died, so.
Yeah, if I'm remembering correctly, he was maybe in his mid-20s.
Okay, way younger than us, even.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, these guys were very young. Him and Gray Barker and Jim Moseley and those guys. And he was born in 1921. So if this sort of hit in 1953... He was 32, so
right.
he was a little bit older, but yeah, it was a young person's game in a lot of ways back then. So guys like Jim Moseley, who was running around forever, it's easy to forget how young he was at the time. I think let's just take 1953, he was sort of running around doing his road trip talking to contactees for the book he ended up not writing until he was very old. He was about 21 or 22 when he was doing a lot of that.
Right.
So just a kid. I look at, the 20 and 21-year-olds that I have in class, and I'm like, or the ones who are out there podcasting now. There are these young folks out there getting involved in the whole UFO thing, and they are just – they're young kids, and that's not, I'm not saying that to denigrate them. I think, you got to rope these people in young, or else they're not going to be interested. But
I notice I'm of the opinion that there aren't. I haven't really been able to find any 20-year-olds involved in the field. So I find that it's like they've moved on to other things.
We
were searching for one in a sense on the show, and the closest we got was Ren Collier, and he's like 31.
Yeah, I guess they aren't as young. Everybody seems young to me nowadays. The other year I went to the 50th anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the UFO sightings in Michigan that Hynek, the swamp gas thing. And
nice.
I went and this is embarrassing. I'm forgetting his name. The guy who wrote the new biography.
Mark O'Connell.
Mark O'Connell.
We had him on the show like a month ago.
Yeah. He did a great job at the presentation and all the interviews he's done about it. It's a good book. The crowd was old. It was an older crowd. There were some young people who were like three college-age students, which is weird that there were only three, because the whole thing took place in a major college town in the middle of the semester. And there was, the usual you know, array of people, but it was mostly people talking about these swamp gas related sightings and other things like that. Peter Robbins was there and did a good talk about the New York Times coverage of UFOs, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And the last presentation was Grant Cameron talking about, you know, Eisenhower meeting the tall whites at Edwards Air Force Base or something like that. And after the show, after the convention was over, I sort of was in a position to talk to these young people who were there. And I said, so what do you think? I'm always interested in what you young people, I think I actually said you young people, you know, think about these sorts of things. And they said they found it all very interesting up until Grant Cameron, who they thought sounded kind of crazy. I'm like, it's a pretty reasonable thing to think.
That's kind of what I was thinking. Like, yeah, no offense to Grant Cameron, but yeah, that was kind of what I was thinking, because it was like,
yeah,
that's a leap of, but that's a big leap in the story.
Yeah, after a whole day of very credible stories by very credible people and people who were not making any sort of leaps. There was something strange. A lot of people saw it. It wasn't investigated as thoroughly as it should have been, you know, and that's about as far out as they went. There wasn't clearly these were flying saucers from Zeta Reticuli. You know, it wasn't anything like that. And then, you know, Cameron comes in and he's doing his Grant Cameron thing, which is great, but it was an odd fit for that conference because it was focused on that one sighting. So, and you know, but yeah, that's, I can see how that would be a little disconcerting. You know, you're maybe putting aside your preconceptions about UFO people for a day to go out and check this thing out about local history. And you think, wow, this is actually a lot more credible and interesting than I thought. And then you get
that boom.
So politics. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's all over. It's all over.
Yeah. That's a very good point. So, I was thinking after I handed off that question about doing the biography too, it's like, if you think about it, I remember Greg Bishop saying that Paul Benowitz's like family wanted like nothing to do with the book. So
yeah,
it's like, you never know what family's reactions to stuff will be. Now, what do you, I lost my train of thought. Yeah. Essentially, that was weird. I don't know why something about that point like stood up, but now I forgot. Oh, now I remember. The train just pulled back into the station. Jesus Christ. Are there anyone? Was Bender like the last of these people that was still alive? I mean, he was 91. He died in 2016. Is there anybody like from that era? I suppose now it'd have to be like a peripheral sort of figure. But is there anyone?
Yeah.
Is there anybody that's even around?
I don't think so, because Mosley died in 2012, and you know, some of the other guys, from Gray Barker died in the early 80s. I'm trying to think of others of that group. August Augie Roberts, who was a photographer of a lot of flying saucer things. I'm not sure when he died, but I do not believe he's still alive.
Yeah.
Frank Stranges, you know, the guy who knew his friend, had his friend Valiant Thor, you know, who visited the Pentagon.
Yeah.
He passed away in the early 2000s, I think. Yeah, I think Al Bender might have been the last of the old guard. I think the oldest one from who we can sort of say is from that era is I think Ray Stanford is probably one of the older ones who's around, and he's in his late 70s, I think, and he's really more of a 60s guy than a 50s guy. But I think if I remember correct, I'm not an expert on Ray Stanford, so all you Ray Stanford experts out there, you know, be a little bit forgiving.
Stanford.
Oh, that's awesome. I think Stanford was. He was, you know, had some dealings with Adamski and some other contactees, you know, when he was sort of a teenager or young adult. But I think his mostly I see him connected with a lot of photographs and Socorro. I think he's one of the Socorro guys. And Socorro's Saucer in the Pentagon Pantry. That's the name of the book. Socorro's Saucer in a Pentagon Pantry, which is...
That sounds festive.
It does. I think it might be the weirdest UFO book title that exists.
No. No. The weirdest UFO book title that exists, I heard from you. It's a UFO appears in Pennsylvania, 1930.
Oh.
Many tragedies occur. The same UFO appears in Michigan, 1996. That's the strangest UFO title.
You're right. What a callback to the pilot episode of Saucer Live. Yeah.
Dude, I love. Yeah. We'll get to Helen later, but I love that whole story.
Yeah, that's a good one.
We'll jump to that now because we need to talk about who's still alive because we're alive and we want to keep going. So talk about this in the pilot episode. You share this story. What amazed me, because. I guess I just lost it in the giant title because there's this woman named Helen. The date's obscuring her name.
Gismondi.
Yeah, Helen Gismondi. There it is. She wrote a book called A UFO Appears in Pennsylvania, 1930. Many tragedies occur. The same UFO appears in Michigan, 1996. That's her book, folks. And And what stunned me, because I kind of... Like, the title is so long, I think even, I wonder if people lost it in translation there too, where it's like, I'm listening to this, because I knew what to expect from the Saucer Life, and I was thinking this was, like, in the 50s, and then later it's like, something happens in 1996, and I'm like, oh my God, this is from now, this crazy UFO experience was happening like 20 years ago or whatever, you know. It was really, really amazing.
And it's interesting. She the book was self published through I'm looking at it right now, through Book World in 1997. It's on Amazon. There's some copies on Amazon, but I found this one in a independent bookstore up in Traverse City, Michigan, about 10 years ago when I was on vacation, and I was like, oh, wow, you know, Michigan UFO book. And then I didn't read it because I had a bunch of other more interesting books, looking books to read. And so I finally read it a couple years ago, and I realized that the entirety of the actual Flying Saucer story is basically contained on the back cover blurb. On November 20th, 1930, a blue metal spaceship-shaped object circled around the body of young Helen Gismondi three times, then vanished into the clouds. The same object reappeared 66 years later, again circling three times. That's the whole Flying Saucer story. That's it. The rest of the book is this message that she supposedly was supposed to give. And, you know, the key part of the title is really the many tragedies occur part. Because
that's just so bizarre.
The first thing in the book is just this timeline of all the horrible stuff this woman has experienced in her life.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder if she went to a therapist at some point and the therapist said, well, why don't you write this all down?
This
was the result. Yeah. It's difficult to read because it just sort of rambles and hops along, and some of it's depressing and some of it is sort of very generic, sort of positivity, self-help kind of stuff. It's a weird book, and when I was trying to think of something compact to do on that first sort of practice episode, I remembered this book, and I was like, well, I know for dang sure nobody has ever heard of this, and it was pretty amazing. I got some comments and some messages from people who, I knew were big UFO buffs, and they said, I have never heard of this book. So I was like, yay.
I was stunned. I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. It was really interesting. It was weird. It was one of those things you almost think, like, you would think it was a joke if you didn't, like, confirm that it exists.
Right. There's some paragraphs in here that I'm pretty sure were, you know, it's like a random word generator that just spat out some of this stuff. Like, you know, plug in like the text of 100 self-help books and then hit a button and it spews out this random paragraph with sentences from all of them. I would say that it's a hidden classic of the UFO genre, but it's not. It's actually pretty terrible as a book, and there's no real story to it. But it's an interesting artifact. I half think that this was just a book of things that Helen had wanted to say to people for years, and somebody told her back in 1997, which was 50th anniversary of Roswell and UFOs were everywhere. Just slap UFO on the cover. Make a UFO story out of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. She died a few years ago.
Was she ever – now, you say it's in the lending library of the MUFON group.
Yes, like, Michigan MUFON, yes.
Did she ever, appear anywhere? Did she ever get into the circuit? Or was she just wrote this shit out and was
– I think she just wrote the book. I think that's all there is. There is one 2-star review on Amazon.
2 stars.
There's another book called Rejection and Betrayal Gave Me the Strength to Succeed, also published in 1997. This was written before the UFO book. It's out of stock, but there's some used ones out there for $7, and I'm strongly tempted to buy one because why not? Right. Actually, I'd be interested to see how similar it is to the UFO thing. She writes the book full stuff. Nobody buys it. She writes the same thing with the word UFO in the title. Maybe that had it had at least one more rating on Amazon.
Oh.
So
why you can't? I assume it's out of print. But are there even any copies available on there, or is it extravagant?
There are. I'm looking at it right now. There are 5 copies available on Amazon, and 8 copies of the UFO book. So 5 copies of the Rejection and Betrayal, 8 copies of the UFO book. Folks out there in banal land, let's make it happen for the heirs of Helen Gismondi or whoever is selling the used copies of her remaindered book. And let's see if we can snap up all 8 copies of A UFO Appears Tonight. will you stand with me, America, and buy Helen's book? I don't blame you if you don't.
It sounds pretty I almost do kind of want to have it as a kitschy curio for my library now. What I find interesting, I'm sure we've talked about this in the past, but I don't know if we've taken it up to the modern level in a sense, because I've been kind of perturbed lately in the last few years by a lot of things, but this one stands out. I've in the past with Nick Redfern, like I said, I'm pretty sure we've explored on the show sort of the evolution from contactees, abductees, but this seems to be a weird modern phenomenon now, where it's bifurcated into I guess you would call them obviously experiencers, or some people who aren't really sure what happened to them, but I think err on the more negative side, and those we don't really need to get into them. They're kind of the modern abductees, but the other part is these people who claim that they are that they're sort of cohabitating with the aliens, that they're friendly.
Right.
With these. There's a girl, I don't want to besmirch her or whatever, but her thing is that she has a bunch of alien babies. I don't remember her name, but she's a woman. Excuse me.
Man.
I forget her name. She's on Facebook. She's been in the Daily Mail and all those places. She does all these circuits and stuff. But it's who are these people? Why? It's a very weird thing. It's it's a new contactee era.
It is. And I think the sort of point of divergence in the whole culture, and this is just my theory, I think that when the exopolitics movement came along in the early 2000s and started talking about, especially early on, that there's a heavy emphasis on getting away from that alien technology that's been hidden to help us get away with fossil fuels, fix the environment, do things like that. You started to have the modern sort of conspiracy-based UFO belief system overlap with the social progress messages of the contactee era. And I think what has ended up happening is there's been, like you said, a rash of sort of encounter or experiencers and having encounters where they have this message that they're bringing back from the aliens, but the cultural sort of image of how one encounters aliens is so wrapped up in the abduction experience that we're getting stories of, I was abducted by the Greys and they told me they want to save the Earth.
Yeah.
Which is completely weird. And what I also find is a lot of people, when I was a couple weeks ago, when I was up at Shag Harbor in Nova Scotia, courtesy of Paul Kimball and the good folks up there, they had a panel. It's an alien abductee panel. So I went to this panel, and there were two sisters who'd had multiple experiences over the course of their lives. And as I'm listening to this, these are positive encounters. They have some sort of deep personal connection to these beings that they've visited with, and they've helped fly the spaceships. They sort of identify them as being akin to the Norse gods, and they're Scandinavian in heritage, and they make a connection there. And I'm sitting here listening, I'm like, this is a contactee story.
Right, right.
This isn't an abduction encounter. This is my friendly space brother, not in a sort of condescending way, but that's what the story is. And I kind of wanted to, make a point during, one of the Q&A sessions when I was sort of talking about, resurgence and recurrence of contact electors. I wanted to sort of get on my soapbox and give a sermon about how that, Don't allow anybody to call you an abductee. Call yourself an experiencer. Make other people call you an experiencer.
Yeah.
Let's resurrect and reclaim the term contactee away from the shysters and hucksters of the 50s and 60s who kind of sullied that for a lot of people. So, let's reclaim it. Let's take it back. Let's not allow it to be a pejorative. Those two women had a very, very interesting story. It's one of those stories that you're probably only going to get a little, relatively small UFO convention in a little town on the edge of nowhere on the Atlantic Ocean in Nova Scotia, where local people are telling local stories. These are not to denigrate. Forcing people to buy them drinks and listen to their alien stories. These are, normal working folks, and they had some strange experiences, and they have a story to tell. And you could tell they're a little nervous about telling the story, probably because they worried people would think they were weird. And they were telling the story, in a lot of ways in front of their neighbors, because there were a lot of locals, because the Shag Harbor crash is a very, local story, and it was sort of local history of that. So it was really great to see that. But I agree with you. I think there's this trend, this sort of bifurcation of abductees and more benign, pleasant, positive experiences breaking off. And I tend to think that the rise of the exopolitics movement had at least a little bit to do with that. And the disclosure movement.
How so?
Because I think it resurrected that idea that when
the aliens
talking,
are like on our friends and shit.
They're our friends, and more broadly, it resurrected the idea that talking about aliens could have a social message. You could say things about issues of war and peace and the environment and poverty and things like that. So it sort of brought back that social justice side of it that really had been missing during the 1990s. And the 1990s, the 80s and 90s were very much about, we are inserting 3-millimeter spherical objects inside their brain cavity through their nose.
Right, right.
And things like that. So we sort of returned to the socially progressive aliens, which honestly, if you look at the channeled stuff, Ashtar Command and Tuella and those people during the 80s and even into the 90s, that stuff never completely went away. I think the nuts and bolts flying saucer thing morphed into the abduction thing, and sort of with Betty and Barney Hill sort of being the catalyst for that. And I think the hardcore contactees of the 50s and 60s go on to, they sort of evolve into the channelers of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Because you can have the entire message without the hassle of having to prove a physical encounter.
Yeah, having to get the aliens
so like,
to show up.
And George Hunt Williamson was doing that back in the 50s with his automatic writing messages that he was getting from, this is my favorite alien name ever, Na-9 of the Solar X Federation.
Oh,
or
wow.
Solar X Council or something like that. Na-9.
How do you spell that? N-A number 9 or N-A-N-I?
N-A, it's N-A-H hyphen 9.
The number 9?
So the number 9, yeah. And N-A-H 9. And I think it was in his book, The Saucers Speak, where he talked about that. And it's the George Hunt Williamson was an interesting guy. He's probably going to be a
future saucer life.
A future saucer life. Yeah, I've got some the second series that I'm planning out now that starts next Tuesday.
Nice.
It will drop. I've got some empty slots, and I think George Hunt Williamson might be one of them. This 6 episodes is going to be. It's going to be about half contactees, the 6 episode block, and the premiere, the season premiere after a gap of the same 2 weeks as we always have between episodes, is it's. I
you should
might
call
change,
it the next chapter. You should call it
the
next
the
chapter.
The next chapter. I might change the notes that play at the beginning. That might be our big change. It's going to be like, you know, second season of Star Trek: The Next Generation, where they had slightly different shows. But nothing else had changed.
Yeah.
The season premiere on the 24th is going to be about the O.H. Krill document.
Yes,
That appeared in 1988 and sort of where that came from and the impact that that whole scene had. I'm gonna be referencing our buddies John Lair, you know, and
oh,
Bill
nice.
Cooper and John Grace. So is John Lair still around?
Oh yeah, John Lear's still around.
Okay. I think his ex sister-in-law was on an episode of Hoarders a
really?
Few seasons ago. Yeah.
How do you
there
know
was
that sort of thing?
Because I love watching Hoarders. And
how would you recognize John Lear's former sister-in-law?
Because the description said she was the and in the episode they say she is the ex, her ex-husband was the son of William Lear. And it wasn't. It was John Lear's brother, basically.
Ah.
So it was one of Lear's other. I was like, wow. I was like, told my wife, you know who that is? That's the ex sister-in-law of a guy who said some flying saucer stuff back in the 80s.
Exactly.
Which,
yeah.
Which, when you say that all out loud, sounds really fanboyish. That people say, are you a saucer believer? Are you a you believe in UFOs? And I say, I'm really kind of a fanboy. I'm not really a believer, but I really like it. And I believe something weird is going on with a lot of these people. But I think to say it's flying saucers is so boring. You know, that's
maybe we need to reclaim UFO buff.
You know, I think we do. I think I think we need to reclaim buff from,
That's like a pejorative too, yeah.
A buff is the guy at the bar who won't shut up about whatever his hobby is. And so when you say, yeah, I'm a history buff, I'm like, oh, God, you just watched like 18 hours of documentaries and you're going to ask me if I knew this and if I knew that for the next 20 minutes. And it's like, oh, no, I got to get out of here. But, I think reclaiming reclaiming UFO fandom and things like that might be an interesting project because, you know, when you look at old guys like Richard Shaver and his Hollow Earth stuff, there were people and still are people who believe, you know, almost literally in the truth of the stories about the Deros and the Taros in the Hollow Earth. But the people who were, you know, his biggest sort of people who followed his work and everything in the 60s and 70s, they described themselves as fans, and they created fanzines. And it was a very different sort of, it was much more akin to science fiction fandom than it was to UFO belief, even though there were some overlaps in the ideas. And you know, and Shaver himself, you know, claimed there was some kind of, you know, substantive truth to his stories, that they weren't fiction. But that became a fandom. Whereas UFOs, because of, you know, people like Donald Kehoe pushing the, you know, these are physical craft and we are going to get information and study these physical craft, and it becomes a science thing. You can't really be a fan of a science thing. And you can't be a fan of a religious thing on sort of the contactee and channeling side.
Yeah.
You have to be a believer or somebody who accepts that this is a possibility. You can't just be a fan of the personalities and a fan of the stories. And actually with the podcast, one of the things I want to do is I want to kind of bring that idea back, that it isn't a question of I believe it, I disbelieve it. This is a cool story, and I think it's pretty interesting. And I think that's a healthy way to look at a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, you have to. I agree on that, because if anything, it's, I'm not really a big fan of a lot of ideas in this field, but I'm a big fan of a lot of the people. So,
yeah.
So, you know, that's a much more accurate description of how I see a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, you know, there are people who I've met and I like a lot, and I don't agree with a single thing they say.
Right, exactly.
But,
yeah.
You know, who cares? You know, we'll get a beer, we'll talk on Facebook, and you know, whatever. It doesn't really matter.
Or the opposite, where it's like I wouldn't want to hang out with them, but I think they're kind of crazy, and I like their crazy story.
Well, I've got a whole list of those people too. like people who are like, hey, do you want to hang out if I'm, you know, near Detroit? But no. I think I'm busy whenever you're here. You know? Because you never know. You never know with some people. There are some nuts out there.
There are some strange folks. Go ahead.
I could be one of those strange folks, you know. You never know.
Here's what I was talking about with this thing with these modern contactees. It's from the Express last October. It says the U.S.-based hybrid children community is trying to recruit more parent breeders in a bid to evolve the human race into a new subspecies, which will take over the Earth when the children currently conveniently housed on giant spaceships return to our planet. And it says women in the group, who include young, glamorous 20-somethings, even claim mating with the reptile-like lizards was the best sex they had ever experienced. And for real, it's like an Antonio Villabois modern day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although and then I read down the article, it says the community was founded by Sharon McCormick, aged in her 60s, and former marketing executive Miss Nielsen. Miss Nielsen's one of the 20 somethings.
Wow.
It's very, yeah. I'll send you the link. You can look at what the.
Absolutely.
Times are when the textile workers around this country are out of work. They got 4 or 5 kids and can't pay their wages, can't buy their food. Hard times are when the auto workers are out of work and they tell them go home. And hard times are when a man has worked at a job 30 years. They give him a watch, kick him in the butt, and say, hey, a computer took your place, daddy. That's hard time. That's hard time.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
And we all had hard times together. I admit I don't look like the athlete of the day supposed to look. My belly's just a little big. My hind is just a little big. But, brother, I am bad, and they know I'm bad.